You're listening to the City Gospel Movement's podcast. Hear inspiring stories that don't always make news headlines, but may just change the way you live out your faith in your city, town, and neighborhood.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us again for the City Gospel Movement's podcast, where we help to celebrate and accelerate gospel work that's happening all over the world. Today, we have the incredible privilege of talking with Chris Lambert, who started Life Remodeled in Detroit, Michigan. They are in the business of remodeling lives one neighborhood at a time. Hey, Chris, how you doing? Thank you so much for joining us here on the City Gospel Movement podcast.
Thank you, Stephanie. It is a pleasure to be with you and all the great listeners out there.
Chris, you are the president and CEO of Life Remodeled. Can you give us just the beginnings of how this whole thing started for you?
Yeah, let me start with who we are, what we do, why we do it. We are a Detroit-based nonprofit. We revitalize neighborhoods in Detroit. And the way we do that is every year we do three things in one Detroit neighborhood at a time. Number one, we renovate a community asset. Number two, we repair owner-occupied homes. Number three, we mobilize 10,000 volunteers in 6 days to beautify 300 city blocks. And obviously, those three things make a very significant impact on physical structures and spaces. But that is not our mission. That's not why we do it. Our real mission is we exist to bridge people across divides in order to help transform each other's lives. And so what we're doing is we're discovering the vision of a community, from the kids, from the youth, from the community leaders. Then we discover what they want for the future, and we bring together people from the city, the suburbs, different races, different religions, different socioeconomic backgrounds. In the process of working on a common vision that everyone believes in, people begin to realize they actually like each other and they need each other. They develop real relationships, which are catalytic for long-term sustainable transformation.
What really was the catalyst for you to want to try and remodel lives in Detroit?
I'll back it up to 2007. My wife and I planted a church in the Detroit area. And one of the things we did when we gathered this small group of people in a little house where we started, we said, you know, the three marks of an evangelical church are preaching, worship, music, and kids ministry. I said, but the bottom line is, no matter how well any church does those three things, the majority of the world around them will never step foot in their church service unless they have an encounter with God where they're at. So we've got to figure out, how do we reach people where they are, love them just the way they are with no strings attached? And we did a lot of different outreaches to try to accomplish that. Well, fast forward to April 2010, I was at a church planting conference, and this buddy of mine comes up to me. His name is actually Alex McManus, the brother of Erwin McManus. And Alex came up to me and he said, "Hey, Chris, have you ever thought about doing a reality TV show?" And I said, "No, man, I hadn't." He goes, "Well, I've got this concept for a show, kind of like the show Clean House, and I think you'd be great for it." And I don't know if you've ever seen that show or if any of the listeners have. It only lasted a year. It was terrible. So,
No, I have not seen it.
Yeah, that's why. And so I said two things to him I'd never said. I said, "Number one, bro, that show sucks." I said, "Number two, if I was going to do a show, I'd probably do something more like Extreme Makeover Home Edition, but more holistic." End of discussion, walked away, not at all serious about doing that. But I'm sure everybody's seen that show, Extreme Makeover Home.
A lot of tears after that one.
I used to watch it from time to time. I would cry every time right at the end, but I would always think to myself, man, I don't think this is the best thing to do for these families, to give them these massive, gaudy homes and then walk away. Then I was learning that anywhere between 17 and 25% of families were losing their homes within the first 2 to 5 years. Their property taxes would go up. Their utilities would go up. They would change their lifestyle to match their new luxurious home. So I came up with this concept and called it Life Remodeled. And it was just for fun, right? I said, what if we build houses in 6 days for low-income families, gave it to them for free because it was just awesome. But what if we took the families through financial training, set them up with a financial advisor? What if we set them up with a clinical psychologist to process family dynamics? What if we offered spiritual guidance, which they could accept or reject? And then what if we invested in the surrounding neighborhood, not just the one house? 2 weeks went by, was not serious about doing it. Then I felt like God spoke to me. And what I felt like he said was, do it. And there were two very clear reasons that came to mind of why. Number one was I knew it would make a significant impact in the lives of people living in poverty, which I'm very passionate about. The second thing that I knew that it would do is it would bring people together from all different walks of life, different races, different religions, different backgrounds, where people would want to be a part of volunteering. And that could create an opportunity for all kinds of life transformation. So at the time, the church my wife and I pastored had less than 200 people. It was in a blue-collar suburb of Detroit. And we had about $8,000 in the bank and two people in the entire church who were not blue-collar. We had a 0% probability of pulling this thing off. 1 year later, April 2011, we did everything I just told you, including producing a reality TV show pilot ourselves, thinking this was going to be the next big show. The show would fund the nonprofit. We'd never have to raise money because at that time in my life, I hated raising money. I only preached on tithing one time my entire time as a pastor. And that's how we got started.
Oh, my goodness, Chris. So take us to today. What has transpired from that time to right now, what you're doing now?
Today, I am sitting right now in my office, which is in a former school building that the school district gave us for $1 a year for 50 years, and we've repurposed it into what is now called the Durfee Innovation Society. And what this building is it's a hub of opportunity for kids and adults in the community to be able to get workforce development opportunities, real-world education, entrepreneurial opportunities, and then a bunch of nonprofits are going to move in here. It's basically an ecosystem of opportunity. And we're doing that. Of course, we're also renovating houses around the community and mobilizing 10,000 people this coming first week in October. And so the vision has gotten a whole lot bigger to where we started by building a house. And then after a few years, that really took off. And then after in 2013, we realized, wow, the neighbors in Detroit are actually getting kind of pissed off that we're only giving one house away for free to one family. They're like, "What? How does this help me?" You know. So we were actually inspired by what was happening in Portland through South Lake Church and that movie that we'd watched, Undivided.
Yes. Be Undivided.
I love that movie. And I said to our board, I was like, "Hey, we should do that. We should renovate schools." And nobody on our board of directors, including me, had any relationship with Detroit Public Schools. I made a cold call. Within 2 weeks, I'm sitting in the office with the top three leaders. I cast this vision that I couldn't prove. And I said, "I can't prove it. You know, that's what we want to do. We want to renovate a school and clean up 300 blocks and renovate a bunch of houses." At that time, they were over $600 million in debt. And so they had nothing to lose. They're like, "Go for it. We're not going to give you any money." Less than a year later, we pulled off a $5.5 million project. And it's just something that everybody agrees that kids should have equitable opportunity for education, that your zip code shouldn't determine your destiny, right? Everybody agrees that people should be able to live in safe environments, not where you're heating your house with your stove or where you've got mold growing because you got a leaky roof over your head. And everybody agrees that you should live in a safe environment, not have to worry about crime, which of course the blight removal that we do helps to eliminate or to reduce crime. So you know, it's tapping into needs and thoughts and ideas that people already have, and mobilizing people to see how collaboratively we can make a pretty significant impact.
Chris, you spend about $5 million a year in a neighborhood. I think the process of how you got to that point of kind of really isolating a neighborhood, not going too far, but going really deep into one community. I think that's an interesting point, and I'd love for you to share that with everybody.
Yeah, it's a super interesting process, and we've got plenty of trial and error and big mistakes. You know, in the nonprofit world, I think oftentimes we try to follow the dollars, or we don't want to, but we end up following those dollars. You know, we always got to show a case of why we're a good fit for that particular fund that we're going after. And we had a funder that offered us $80,000 to get into workforce development, and we took it. Stupid mistake. And we ended up saying, "Yeah, we wanted to renovate a couple of vacant houses anyway, and we'll train these kids how to do it." And we had a couple contractors saying, "Oh, yeah, this is going to be great. We're going to do it." And over time, we learned that it was just a massive drain on our resources. And we certainly expended more than $80,000 the money when it really is all said and done. And we realized, wow, there's already plenty of other people out there doing workforce development. We should just partner with them instead of trying to do it ourselves. And so for us, what it comes down to, we've landed on those three particular things because we know that for us, mobilizing a vast amount of volunteers is a big part of what we do. It's about the camaraderie. It's about the energy. It's about the amount of work that can be done by 10,000 people in a 6-day time period. So that's pretty central to who we are and what we do. And it's important that we're not just mobilizing 10,000 people with a toothbrush and saying, clean this floor because we got to give you something to do. It's important that we actually have them doing real meaningful work. So we spend a lot of time developing that experience and that work every year so that it really matters. And then we decided to do the home repair thing because we just have a lot of relationships with a lot of contractors who donate either a roof, a furnace, or windows. So that's why we've narrowed it down to those three things. We used to do electrical, we used to do plumbing. We used to have churches adopt homes, and some of them would go all out. And it was awesome, but it caused a massive problem.
Interesting.
I'm sure people have read When Helping Hurts or Toxic Charity, you know, and some houses were getting decked out, and other houses were getting a brand new furnace and a brand new roof. And they're like, well, why didn't I get, you know, all the new couches and the carpet and the... And so we realized, okay, no more of that. We're just going to stick to critical repairs, and it's going to be based on how many do we get donated. If we get X amount of roofs donated, that's how many roofs we'll do. If we get this many furnaces, that's how many furnaces. Same thing with windows.
Chris, I think it is so interesting. And how do you identify those communities that you're going to work with? And then secondly, how do you mobilize 10,000 people to show up to do a week's worth of work?
Yeah, let me start with how we choose neighborhoods. So we look for two things. We call it significant need and radical hope. And it's not a science because every neighborhood has their own story of strengths and opportunities and weaknesses and so on and so forth. And of course, every major city around the country looks different. So here's what it looks like in Detroit. When it comes to significant need, we're looking for neighborhoods that have high levels of crime and high levels of what we call blight. Right? Blight is vacant structures or overgrown brush and weeds and illegal dumping and just stuff that looks terrible and actually leads to criminal activity.
This has been a really big problem for Detroit, right?
Big problem. You know, we were a city with 1.8 million people. We have 650,000. So you can't move out that many people and maintain a city and expect it to look good. And we also look for areas that have academic challenges that can somehow be addressed through construction projects. That's what we call significant need. Now, when it comes to radical hope, again, we don't believe any neighborhood in Detroit is hopeless, but we do believe many neighborhoods have not yet come to realize the hope that they have. So we're looking for neighborhoods that already have grassroots efforts in play for sustainability, or there's a real strong foundation that's in process where there's a lot of potential for sustainability. And so most neighborhoods in Detroit have the significant need, but once you look toward, you know, that sustainability factor, the pool starts to narrow down significantly. And you asked about, you know, how do we mobilize 10,000 people? How do we get them to show up? So, you know, it's kind of like a party. A lot of people RSVP and show up, and a lot of people RSVP and don't show up. A lot of people don't RSVP and they do show up. So, you know, the key for us is getting large groups of people to come. That's where you get the massive amounts of numbers. And corporations and churches are the two entities that send the largest volume of people at one time. General Motors one year sent 3,700 volunteers in one week, and Chrysler every year sends about 1,000 or 1,200. Quicken Loans sends a number of people and other companies. And then you'll have churches that will communicate this from the stage. And the ones that do that end up, you know, mobilizing pretty large numbers of people. We always encourage companies and churches to do internal signups. We used to try to get them to sign up on our website. Big mistake, because we found that people are much more likely to sign up when it's their organization asking them to volunteer. And when there's
interesting
an internal sign up, they're much more likely to to go through with that. And they want to be around people that they know. And so we try to organize this experience where you're going to volunteer with people you came with, but you're also going to volunteer alongside people who are different than you. And so, you know, there's some organizing pieces and then there's some organic pieces. The organized pieces, it's just like if you go to a new restaurant and you have a great experience, you're going to tell one person, oh, that was a great restaurant. If you go and have a terrible experience, you're going to tell like seven people, oh man, that restaurant was awful.
That's terrible.
So to build up to 10,000 people to where we are now regularly, we've had to deliver on that volunteer experience year after year after year and organize it in a way that people are going to get to work right away. They're going to work very hard. They're never going to run out of work. And they're going to get to a place where they're done. They're like, poof, I put in enough. And they're going to see their impact visually and know, man, it was important for me to be here today. And that is a successful volunteer experience.
Yeah, that's right. Because you didn't start with 10,000 people.
No.
You had to create an experience that people wanted to come back to. Wouldn't you say that's true?
Correct.
And Chris, this is cumulative, right? Because you're not getting 10,000 new people each year. So how are you creating something where people want to just keep coming back to?
Yeah, there's a lot of repeats. And then there are a lot of new ones we pick up as well. And one of the things I didn't mention that we always try to do is invite churches and companies to stick in the communities that we bring them to. So we've had multiple churches in different areas make commitments to the school that we served in that year. And so we've lost some of those churches from continuing on with us in our ongoing work because they've gained a new partnership with the community, which is something to celebrate, right?
Absolutely.
Like General Motors now has stayed in one of the communities we mobilized them in. And so we had to fill in 3,700 volunteers, right?
Ah, oh, that's so great though. That's community development, when people from all walks of life are getting to experience investing in people.
Well, one of the big goals is to move people from volunteering once a year, which most people want to do, right, to a lifestyle of volunteerism. And so this six-day project is a springboard, and then we begin to link people up with other opportunities and other organizations where they can really find their niche. But you talked about, you know, what do we do to make sure that that's a good experience? So I would say, you know, not everything can in life can handle 10,000 volunteers, right? I mean, I'll be the first to tell you that. There's plenty of things you can't do. Like this school building, you can't put 10,000 volunteers in here. Most we've ever put in here at one time, I think, was about 250 or 300. And then we got this building to a place where you can't use non-professional volunteers. You got to have skilled volunteers doing the vast majority of projects that still remain in this building. We don't do any home repairs with non-professional volunteers.
All licensed people.
All licensed. We learn from experience. There's too much that can go wrong. You do a roof wrong.
That makes sense. Single,
it's leaking and then you got issues and who's going to come back and fix it, right? That volunteer? No. Now, in Detroit, you know, one of the big problems is all this blight. Well, that's a lot easier to mobilize a bunch of people to cut down overgrown brush and weeds and bring illegal dumping to the curb where front-end loaders will pick it up and board up vacant properties. I don't want to call it easy, but, I mean, it's easier to mobilize a large number of people for something like that than what we're doing this year. We're going to get into a little bit of tree planting, a little bit of perennial planting. We're going to do some safe route stuff. We're going to do some little free libraries, some bus shelters, some park benches, and a whole lot of blight removal. It's a lot easier to mobilize them on the blight removal than it is that stuff that takes more prep work and more coordinated effort to say, all right, this tree needs to go right there. So a key to a large-scale volunteer experience is having very simple work and having very simple instructions. And then what we do is we have what we call red shirt leaders because they're wearing red t-shirts. Everybody on the Life for Model project is wearing a Life for Model t-shirt. companies and churches, typically we always ask them to, and they usually do. They choose the color of their shirt, then they put their logo on the back. That way they know, you know, their company. But if you're a red shirt, you're leading 10 people. And so what happens is you're going to show up to our project. You're going to park. Then you're going to get on a bus. You're going to go to a command center. There's two command centers a day. You're going to go to one or the other. That's where you're going to get your tools. That's where you're going to eat your free lunch. That's where you're going to get in a group with 10 people and a red shirt leader. That red shirt leader doesn't ever have to have any life or model leadership experience. We train them in a 10-minute video. It's very simple. They then tell you how many tools to take, what you're going to do. You go out and you do it. And when you're done, you're done. And you come back, you get on a bus, and you leave.
Well, you make it sound quite simple, Chris, but I know this has been years of developing this program. Chris, you talk about not serving communities, but serving alongside them. What kind of has been the stimulus for that kind of difference of communication and thinking?
Yeah, I can say it's a lot easier to say that, you know, we serve with neighborhoods. We don't serve neighborhoods. It's easy to say. It's very difficult to achieve. I would say from a sustainability standpoint, there's probably nothing more impactful than involving as many community leaders and youth in the designing of the project and the implementation of the project. Again, easier said than done. The neighborhoods where we work in Detroit have experienced a lot of vacancy. The vast majority of residents are renters. And there's a lot of moving around where you're in one neighborhood one year, you're in another neighborhood another year. So there's not a lot of investment typically from a renter in a low-income area in maintaining the surrounding community. The majority of homeowners are senior citizens. And so you're not going to see a whole lot of them, you know, having the stamina to be able to get out there, even though a lot of them do, and get out there and join an effort with 10,000 people. So it takes a lot of time to build relationships, and to build relationships to a point where you gain enough trust to where people will say, I do want to serve with you. I do trust you in this neighborhood because you don't look like me, right? And I, you know, you got to remember that in Detroit, people have a history of people who look like me coming in and taking over their neighborhood, developing it out from under their feet, kicking them out, raising prices, or coming in with some high and mighty attitude as a volunteer, like, oh, look at you and your messed up area. Oh, believe me, I come from a great neighborhood. I know what you need, and I'm going to fix this place right up, right?
Yeah, a lot of history, huh?
A lot of history, 400 years of history, right, for African-Americans in Detroit. And so to build that trust, you got to do a lot of breaking bread, and we're very strategic on finding out who are the leaders. You know, you've got people who lead by position, you've got people who lead by influence, and then you got people who have both position and influence. And we try to find those three types of leaders and really get to know them in a way that they trust us, and then they open up their relational networks to others.
Those are tough learnings, but such great advice, Chris. Hey, I know you had a visitor from Washington, D.C. out recently, Dr. Ben Carson from HUD. Tell us about Dr. Carson's visit.
Yes, so HUD has come up with a new designation. They're called Envision Centers. And what it is it's a designation for bricks and mortar sites. There's now 18 of them in the country. We're the first one. They have four pillars. They're looking for economic advancement, educational advancement, health and wellness, and character and leadership and development. That's really six things, but they put them into four somehow. And
always cutting costs.
Yeah, I guess. So they've chosen our site, and to talk about cutting costs, you know, here's the pros and cons of this partnership. So the cons are there's no money attached to it. Yay. But the pros to it, and this is where it could really be a great thing, is they want to mobilize 21 federal agencies out of this building. So they'll operate out of this building, Department of Labor, Department of Health, the Social Security, you name it. And the goal is they'll be able to streamline opportunities for residents and also for many of our tenants who are in this building, working on workforce development and other initiatives. So the concept is great. It's one in which they're still building the plane while flying it, which I'm very used to us doing that as well. So I'm comfortable with that. And then they're also inviting the business community, the philanthropic community, to get behind these Envision Centers. So that's really been a boost, because there have been several groups that have said, oh yeah, this is interesting. But the flip side of that is, you know, Detroit didn't vote for the current administration and isn't real excited about Dr. Ben Carson, even though he grew up in Detroit, right? This is not a Republican city. And so we made very sure that we were not going to go forward with this partnership at all unless the community wanted it and voted for it. And after three meetings with executive leadership from HUD and the community actually said, no, we want to go forward with it and we want to see what it can produce. So let's do it. And that's how we ended up in this situation. And I'm hopeful. I'm looking for, you know, the real investment, and we're working toward it, but it's probably going to take about a year to really figure out if it's going to work.
It's so important to keep an open mind and make sure that those who are affected most have a say and have a platform to speak. Chris, one of the things I absolutely love about you is that you have a go big or go home attitude. What happens inside of you that says, yeah, we can do this, or I can get that building for a dollar for the next 50 years. I mean, where did that all start? And where is that in you that just pushes past all of those obstacles and can see a bigger story?
I don't know the exact answer to that question. To kind of reflect on it, I've been that way my whole life, for good or for bad, right? And for 6 years of my life, that took me very far away from Jesus. And I lived that life as, hey, I was going to live whatever is going to make me happiest. So if it's not Jesus, I'm going to go find out what it is. And I lived that life, right? And so I lived that way in that life. And then when I came to Jesus in 2002, I didn't see any other way to live, you know, than all in. Like, if you found something good, you might as well
go for it,
bet everything on it, right? And so one, I don't really understand a mindset of where anyone lives life other than fully committed to whatever they believe is the best things in life, right? So I would just encourage you, anybody, to do that in general. And it is Jesus, right? I mean, he is. So when it comes, though, to getting involved in really big projects, I got to say that that thing that's inside of me, that's a gift from God, can also be a curse, because along with our greatest gifts, I think, comes in areas of immaturity and blind spots, to where, you know, I can say, well, we did this big thing before, do this bigger thing now, you know, and the adrenaline can take over. And that's where you need wise people in your life, and the prayer and the time to reflect with God of, where is this my ambition and where is this you? And, constantly evaluating along the way, like, okay, we thought you said this, God, but now this is happening. We need your guidance again on where to go next. And so it's a balance, but I do think people often do take the easy route out, or they play it safe. And I can say it's hard for people to get behind a vision that's not ambitious. So, you know, you got to think about all those different factors and then just make a decision that you believe God's leading.
Yeah, Chris, what are those checks and balances for you? Do you have a board of directors? How are you structured so that you can bounce ideas off of and dream big, but also have reality?
Yep. We have a board of directors. We meet six times a year. We just met today. And very fresh and very sobering board, where our discussions are absolutely phenomenal. So you got to get people on your board who have tremendous amounts of wisdom. I say we look for three things. I stole this from somebody else. You know, we look for wisdom, wealth, and work. And I look for board members who have at least two of those things that they can bring to the table. And the wisdom piece is, you know, people being able to speak into the situation from experience and be able to look you right in the eye and say, you know, exactly what they think based on the information that's been presented to them. Then when it comes to, you know, how big of a project to take on, that's very much defined by what the community wants and what the community needs. And then testing that out with specific donors and seeing if they get behind it, right? I mean, you can have the greatest idea in the world, but if you start testing the waters and donors are like, no, I'm not really feeling that. I mean, it might be a good sign to say, that's not your thing to get behind, right? It would be a great idea, but people aren't ready for it. Or you might not be the person to carry that ball across the finish line. And I guess through experience with others and testing various scenarios, I've learned where my niche is, where Life Remodeled's niche is, and where that's compatible with where people want to go.
Yeah. I mean, just coming off your board meeting today, what's next for Life Remodeled? What are some of your big dreams for the future?
What I believe God wants to do is I believe he wants to see this particular project, this facility that's now an ecosystem, become a massive success to where we would do this again and again in other neighborhoods in Detroit and eventually in other cities. But you can't get ahead of ourselves. This one's got to be a success before we can do those other things. And you know, I'm having conversations with other cities and they're saying, oh, we want you to come and, you know, this would be great. But that's where I have to measure those conversations and hit the brakes and say, look, I can only go this far in those conversations. We're only looking at scouting opportunities. If you were interested in us coming, how much money would you give to this if we were to come? Again, I can't commit until this project's sustainable. So there's really a balance between working on new frontiers and making sure that what you're doing now is successful to the point where you can move to a new frontier.
Right, right. Going deep enough before you go wide.
There you go.
Chris, what's the best advice you've ever received?
I don't know. I don't have the quick answer to that one. I have a terrible memory for like one-liners and things like that. I can say what comes to my mind right now in terms of this work that we do is relationships are absolutely everything. Obviously, number one, which goes without saying, but we need to say it anyway, is our relationship with God, because I'm going to give him all the credit for all the good things that we've gotten. And I believe that very much has to do with our relationship with him. And then the second relationship would be with everybody else, because this work that we do, again, we can have all the great ideas in the world, but if people don't like you, and that doesn't mean you need to be a charismatic person, but it means you got to put people over projects. And that's one of our core values, is we say our projects are exceptionally valuable, but people are priceless. And so sometimes that means we have to slow down on certain projects that we're doing and just sit in the moment in a very difficult situation with people and learn and be rebuked. And I mean, I've had my teeth kicked in metaphorically in this neighborhood and accused of being a colonizer. And instead of getting defensive, I had to learn, well, why would someone think that? And had to appreciate and respect, like, oh, that makes sense why they said that and they think that. And I have a lot more to learn right now than I have to teach. And that value of people over projects, I think, puts those things in perspective to where you can really follow God in that moment instead of saying, oh, this isn't turning out the way I wanted. Let me just get rid of this person and move forward.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much for sharing with us about yourself and Life Remodeled and the things that are happening there in Detroit. If people want to get a hold of you and Life Remodeled, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, if anyone wants to donate $4 million today and solve our crisis, they can go to liferemodeled.com, liferemodeled.com. Even though we're .com, we're a 501c3, and your $4 million will be tax deductible.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and thank you for the Plow organization. I love what you guys are doing on bringing leaders together and communicating from different leaders' perspectives. And I'm honored to be a part of it and excited to learn from others. So thank you for putting together this network.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's always so fun to be with you. And I'm sure everybody else has gotten a little flavor of who you are. So thank you, and all the best to the next couple of months and some of your big events and happenings going on. That's it for us on the City Gospel Movement podcast. If you want more information and stories, please go to citygospelmovements.org. If you want to send us a question, if you want different podcast material, again, please share your thoughts and ideas with us. Thanks, everybody.